gripping her wrists. Her foot, however, flopped down awkwardly, her ankle twisting in a way it wasn't meant to twist. Pain flared up her leg and she cried out. Gat skidded to a stop and pivoted back toward her. He grabbed her under the arms, helping her to her feet, but when she took the first step, her ankle buckled. He steadied her, but she could see the fear in his eyes. "Can you hang on to my back?"
"No. Leave me," she said,
a pang of fear snaking through her at her own words. And yet she felt right about this. She'd been the one to drag him into this fool's errand.
"You can get away. Please."
"Never," Gat said. "I will never leave you. Now, can you hang on, or must I carry you in my arms? The former will be faster."
"I think so," she said,
her vision blurring, both from the pain and her brother's loyalty. She hazarded a glance behind them. Their pursuers were so close now, the closest they had been, increasing their speed upon seeing their quarry stopped. Gat crouched down and Sonika climbed aboard, wrapping her good leg around his torso and her arms across his chest, being careful not to choke him. He ran. Despite the fight and the long gallop across the desert and the exhaustion he must have been feeling, he ran. His powerful strides bobbed her up and down, drawing the rocky spires ever closer. The burning sea wasn't so much burning as churning, whitecaps frothing along its night-dark surface. Sonika didn't look back. Didn't want to look back.
"I will never look back again," she thought. "If we survive this, I will only look to the future, a better future, of my own creation."
Gat began to grunt with exertion, huffing out heavy breaths. She could feel the sweat soaking through his shirt, feel the pounding of his heart from within his strong chest. And then they were there, rounding the first spire and pounding up a low rise leading into a land of boulders. In the daylight, Sonika knew, these rocks would be as red as fire, but in the dark they might have been sleeping monsters as dark as the void. Gat seemed to choose a random path through the boulder field, meandering left and right, always ensuring his pursuer's view would be blocked by at least one obstruction. He was groaning now, and Sonika felt lower to the ground, his form beginning to hunch from her weight.
"Gat," she said, "please, just leave me. We can't both be caught. I can't let that happen."
To her surprise, he stopped, seeming to consider her words.
"Slide off," he said.
She did, slowly, favoring her uninjured leg.
"Here," he said,
wrapping her arm around his shoulders.
"Gat, you have no say in this, Sonika," he hissed, silencing her. "I listened to you. Now you'll listen to me."
She said nothing, allowing him to help her hobble to an odd formation of rocks. They seemed to huddle together, boulders of various sizes. The shadows were the thickest between them.
"Crawl in there," Gat ordered.
She obeyed, dragging her injured leg behind her. The space was small and pitch black. And yet...
"It's wide enough for both of us," she whispered excitedly.
No response.
"Gat?"
Wind whistled through the rocklands, taking her voice with it. Realizing what Gat had done, she started to crawl out. Voices stopped her. Not her brother's. Gat was gone. Gat Vade. Gat peered at their pursuers from behind a nearby boulder. They had slowed now, and were picking their way through the rocklands, talking in low tones he could just make out.
"They're too tired to keep running,"
one man said. The leader, the one who had saved his own life in exchange for their escape from the mine.
"And the girl is injured,"
another agreed.
"Spread out. Search every boulder. Holler if you see one of them and we'll come running."
They did, each man choosing a different spot, using torches to chase away the shadows. There were seven of them, the leader plus six newcomers from the other side of the mine. At least the other five were hurt badly enough they had to stay back, Gat thought, or dead. He still couldn't believe what Sonika had done, drawing the man's own blade across his throat as easily as a knife through soft butter. He wasn't sure how he felt about it yet, only that it might have saved their lives. At least, so far. He shook away his thoughts, focusing on the present. No one was headed toward where Sonika was hiding yet, but they would, eventually. He hoped she had enough sense to stay well hidden. It was a good spot, and a cursory search would reveal nothing. The crawl space was tight. They might not even think someone could fit through there. But there was still a chance they would try.
I can't let that happen. I won't.
He took a deep breath, and then stepped from the shadows. He uttered a curse loud enough the guards would hear, pretending to be surprised upon stumbling into them. He turned tail and ran. The sounds of pursuit fell in behind him. Though he was tired, his legs felt light now that he wasn't carrying his sister on his back. Instead of racing further into the rocklands like they might expect, he circled a large boulder all the way around and shot back toward the sea. One man blocked his path. The master opened his mouth to shout for the others, but Gat didn't stop, lowering his shoulder and barreling into him. The man lashed out with both fists at the same time. One blade whistled past Gat's ear, while the other sliced open his shoulder. He stumbled, but used the guard to keep his balance, driving his knee into his midsection, pushing off of his chest. However, the guard managed a final kick, catching Gat in the abdomen with his bladed foot. Luckily, Gat was still moving away and the bite was shallow, but he still felt the warmth of blood. He clutched the wound, still running, trying to stem the flow. He burst from the rocklands, cutting left toward the ocean. Sunlight was working its way over the horizon, and a fire seemed to burn along the water. It truly is the burning sea, he thought. He looked back to find all seven men in pursuit, though the seventh, the man who had kicked him, was slower. Gat smiled. Sonika was safe. And she was resourceful. Her ankle would heal. She would find food, maybe even a way to cross the border into Calypso, which was exactly where he was headed. To a land of freedom, a land without slavery. Empress Sands would be his ruler now, and he her loyal subject. He would find Sonika and they would have allies. Together they could carry out their parents' dream of a rebellion in Fanes. Together they would change the world for the better. The water was so close now he could smell the salty tang of the sea breeze, feel the misty spray on his face as waves crashed against the rocky shoreline. He stumbled down a slight slope, careening toward a low cliff with a large, flat rock only partially wet. Carefully, he clambered across the slick surface, using his hands to maintain his balance. Below, the sea was angry, crashing against the cliff. Behind him, the men stopped, realizing their prey was either cornered or about to escape their clutches to a more unpredictable danger. Gat waved, more to be a bastard than a farewell. And then he turned and jumped. Sonika obeyed. Sonika had watched as the searchers spread out, as one of them drew closer and closer to where she was hiding, like she was the flame and he the moth. But then there had been a muffled curse and shouts, and the guard had raced off, along with all the others, or so she believed, given the number of footfalls slapping against the rocks. Oh, gods, she had thought. They found Gat. Now, however, as she listened to the night, which was swiftly becoming dawn, a realization began to rise to the forefront of her mind with the coming sun. He led them away from me. He saved me. First, when he'd carried her this far, and then again when he'd distracted their pursuers away from her. She bit her lip, trying to hold back tears. They would catch him, she knew, and they would kill him. A sound caught her attention, a single rock bouncing and bounding down the slope. She drew her head further inside her hidey-hole, trying to determine whether the wind had blown the stone from above or if someone had kicked it. She jumped when a voice said, "I know you're in there." Hands slid into the hole, reaching for her. Gat Vade. The Phoenician slave masters hadn't jumped in after him. No. They'd simply watched from the shore as Gat struggled against the powerful currents and rolling waves before turning their backs. They probably think the sea will finish me off, Gat thought. Only it wouldn't. He'd been pretending to struggle, drifting beneath the water for longer and longer stretches, flailing his arms dramatically. Those who lived in the canyon city of Fenir generally couldn't swim. There was simply nowhere to learn. Gat's parents, however, had believed it to be an important skill, and had taken he and his sister to the reservoir when they were children, showing them how to move their arms, to kick their legs, to stay afloat. Now that the guards were gone, Gat swam with long, easy strokes, barely kicking his exhausted legs, letting them rest while his arms did most of the work. Thankfully, the current was with him, though he had to fight the waves for a while. Although he was comfortable in the water, he didn't enjoy that certain aspects were out of his control. A storm could come upon him, for example, and then his life would be forfeit. Or a predator could arise from the depths and finish him with a single snap of its mighty jaws. He tried not to think of these things, however, focusing his energy on each stroke, on each breath, watching as the distant shores grew less and less distant. He was far out to sea, but he tracked his progress as the red rocklands of Fane's inched along, eventually giving way to a wide river which poured into the burning sea. The Spear, he thought. The mightiest river in all the four kingdoms. Or so his father always said. Beyond it was Calypso. Once he was well past the point of no return, he angled himself toward shore, letting the waves wash into him from behind, using their momentum to drift landward. He tried not to worry about his sister. Instead, he thought of how their reunion would be when he finally found her again. The thought buoyed him up, spurring him to kick faster. He reached the shoreline, which was less rough than that of Fane's, just a sandy slope, gradually getting shallower until his feet touched. The water fell beneath his shoulders, then his hips, and then he was sloshing onto dry land. The land of freedom, he thought, with excitement. This is the start of something great, a new life, a chance to make our parents proud, a hope for... He froze when he saw the forms rise up from behind the dunes of the Skara Desert. They wore sand-blown leather armor that blended with the terrain so well he had to stare right at them, else he'd lose track of their positions. Two of them rode enormous scaled beasts, while the other two stood. One of the beasts snapped its jaws. Though Gat had never seen one of the fabled monsters, he knew them well enough by description. The Guanic, he thought. Which meant these men were the Guanero, the elite Calypsian warriors commanded by Empress Sans herself. My new allies, he thought, firming his chin, striding forward to meet them. I am Gat Vade, he said as he approached. They didn't respond, four sets of eyes staring at him. Their skin was various shades of brown, the antithesis to the powdered white flesh of the Phoenician elite. He moved closer. With each step, Gat realized just how large these men were. They were packed with muscle and bristling with weapons, scimitars and longswords and daggers. I come seeking refuge. My sister and I were— You are Phoenician, one of the Guanero finally said. Gat didn't think he needed to respond to that. His narrow eyes and strong features certainly gave that much away. Like I was saying, I am seeking refuge. The only refuge for our enemies will come in death, the man said. Gat stopped. Wait, just listen to what I have to— Death will find you, eventually. But not today. Today you are our prisoner. What? No, I can prove what I— When Phoenicians speak, they lie. Therefore, anything you say is a lie. Gat shook his head. This wasn't going the way he'd planned at all. I'm telling you the truth. I will say the same to your Empress. I will prove I am an ally, not the en— Silence! Bind him! One of the Guanero dismounted to join the other two on foot, and the three moved toward him. Gat's arms dropped to his sides. He had nothing left, and anyway, he didn't want to fight these men. They were on the side of freedom for the slaves. They were not his enemy. As they shackled his arms behind his back and his legs together, he asked the man still mounted, "Where are you taking me?" In the back of his mind there was a ray of hope, a spark of light that told him he would be fine as long as he went to Calypso. There he could convince someone to grant him an audience with the Empress. He could pretend to have information that would help them win the civil war. Something. But the Guanero's response chased all hope away. You are going to Zoon. You will die in the fighting pits. The moment before the dark bag was thrown over his head, Gat thought, Goodbye, Sonica. Make us all proud. Blackness surrounded him. Sonica Vade. She clawed at the hands, tried to grab them and bite them, anything to survive for a breath longer, a moment longer, to make her brother's sacrifice worth it. Ow! the voice cried, withdrawing. That's when Sonika realized it was the voice of a woman. Caught in the throes of fear and survival, she'd missed it the first time. Still, it could be a trap, a ruse of some kind.
"Who are you?" she asked. "Gods, did you bite me?"
"And I'll bite you again if you don't answer my question.
I'm trying to help you. I saw those men chasing you. Slavers."
She spit the word out like a vile taste in her mouth.
"I saw you hide. I saw your friend lead them away. You saw my brother. Is that who he was? Tall, strong. Yes, I saw him. Is he alive?"
"I don't know. I'm sorry. I lost sight of him.
But those slavers looked pretty determined.
What are you doing here? What do you think I'm doing? Hiding, like you?"
Sonika tried to think, though it was hard with her ankle continuing to throb.
"Why are you hiding?"
The girl paused for a moment.
"Maybe I should show you. You don't have to come all the way out. Just peek into the light."
Sonika considered. It could be a trick, but it didn't feel like one. Still, as she eased forward, she remained on guard. The moment she emerged into the sunlight, she saw the arm hovering before her. The skin held a soft, reddish hue. This girl was Terran, and the only Terrans in Fanes were slaves.
"See," the girl said, "I'm not your enemy, and I know anyone running from the slavers is my friend."
She stuck out a hand.
"I am Shanti Parthena Lord, and you are?"
Sonika stared at the hand in disbelief. She'd never spoken to a Terran like this. The only Terrans she knew were slaves, their minds twisted by the Emperor. And this girl was young, slender but strong-looking, as brash as the day was long. She took her hand, squeezing it.
"I'm Sonika. Sonika Vade."
The girl nodded.
"Come on, Sonika. I know somewhere safe, where you can rest and we can talk."
Sonika watched as the girl, Shanti, she remembered, bound her ankle with the flexible roots of a plant known only to grow in the desert. She wondered what her story was, how it was possible for her to be here. Her neck was free of the typical black markings of slaves, the mystical tattoo of a collar and chains. Every Terran over the age of 10 in Fanes had the marking. But she didn't. Somehow she had escaped.
"Tell me your story," she said.
The girl's eyes darted up, and for a moment they became deep blue pools of sadness. But then she blinked, and they seemed sheathed in pearlescent armor.
"I lost my family. My father. My sister. Maybe my mother, too. I don't know. So I left. I ran away."
Sonika stared at her in awe.
"Just like that? Just like that? Don't ask me how. I was marked, and now I'm not. That's all I know."
"I'm glad you're here," Sonika said.
"Thank you for helping me."
A smile ghosted across Shanti's face, but then vanished, just like the sad look in her eyes had.
"I have food and water. Not much, but I think it's enough for both of us for a while. You can stay with me if you want."
There was hope in the suggestion. Hope that she didn't need to be alone anymore. Sonika felt it as much as she was certain the girl was thinking it. She spotted an inkwell, quill, and swatch of parchment. They were in a small cave, well hidden by the girl, who had created her own makeshift avalanche over the entrance. Sonika had been impressed by how realistic it had looked from the outside. There was a secret way in, however, by clambering up to the top of the fallen rocks and then dropping down through a hole. The landing had aggravated Sonika's ankle, but at least they were safe. She continued to study the writing materials, an idea forming in her head. She wasn't sure why she thought it, only that their shared losses seemed to magnify in this small space. She felt the urge to do something to commemorate those they'd lost, the beautiful souls they carried with them everywhere they went. She felt the tears forming behind her eyes, but she didn't want to cry, not anymore. These losses were permanent, just as her tears were permanent, even if they never fell.
"I stole them from my master before I left,"
Shanti explained, noticing where Sonika was looking.
"Do you have a knife?"
Shanti raised a coppery eyebrow. She was a beautiful girl, Sonika realized. A little dirty, a little ragged,
but even that couldn't hide the strong beauty she wore like a second skin.
Why?
I want to. She struggled to explain. Let me show you. I'll need the inkwell, too.
The girl hesitated, but then shrugged, pulling a knife from a satchel and sliding the inkwell over. Sonika held the knife firmly, dipping it in the ink, just enough so the tip was coated but not dripping. She held the knife up to her cheek.
What are you doing?
The girl said quickly.
Giving myself a tattoo, she said, trying to zone in on the right spot, just below her right eye.
Let me do it, Shanti said, reaching for the knife.
When Sonika pulled back, she added,
You can't tattoo your own cheek. You can't even see where you're aiming.
It was a fair point.
Sonika handed her the knife. A black tear, she said. One beneath each eye.
Shanti bit her lip.
For your mother.
The girl was shrewd for her age. Sonika had to give her that.
And father.
One for each person I lost.
Your brother?
Sonika ground her teeth together.
No. I don't know that I've lost him. He doesn't get a tear until it's certain.
Shanti nodded.
Lay back. Hold still.
She did, closing her eyes and then felt the sting of the blade entering her skin. She didn't cry out, didn't flinch. Instead, she poured every positive memory of her parents into the pain she felt, infusing the black tears with the spirits of those she loved most. When Shanti had finished, she leaned back, inspecting her work.
Well,
Sonika said.
Tears,
Shanti said.
They look like black tears.
Sonika nodded.
Thank you. Now do me.
What?
Two, Shanti said. One for my father, one for my sister.
Sonika squinted. This girl was so young, and yet she wasn't naive. She'd been to the void and back again, the maturity gained from her experiences making her seem at least 5 years older, a woman grown. This was her choice.
Are you certain? Yes.
And your mother?
No, she said. She doesn't get a tear until it's certain.
Sonika felt a flutter in her chest at hearing her own words echoed back at her. As Shanti lay back and Sonika dipped the blade in the ink, this unexpected friendship felt like the start of something important.
No, she wouldn't waste the sacrifices of her parents or brother. They hadn't liberated any slaves, but they had struck a blow to the Empire.
And an injury like that had a way of festering. She pressed the blade to Shanti's cheek.
Black tears, she thought.
Postlude 4. Sir Dietrich. The Northern Kingdom, circa 528.
Long before he was Sir Dietrich, the sword-marked knight was known as David Dietrich, a career soldier of 16, who'd left home at age 12, 4 years after his father was murdered publicly on the streets of Gearhead. He was murdered by none other than Wulfric Geric, the Dread King himself, as punishment for refusing to join the Northern Army during a time of war. Though David had vowed on that day, now 8 years past, never to work for the king, he didn't consider being a soldier a breach of that promise. No, being a soldier was about protecting the innocence of the realm, which included his mother. More personally, it was his own punishment for being so weak all those years ago. Before he'd left home, his mother had told him that what had happened to his father wasn't his fault, her argument founded on the fact that he was only 8 years old when the tragedy had occurred. He listened to every word, but dismissed them out of hand. Because it was his fault. His age was irrelevant. He was sword-marked, a fact only his father, mother, and he knew. Despite the power coursing through his body, he didn't so much as lift a finger to help his father. Not when they dragged him through the streets, not when they tied him to the post, and finally, not when the king slid a blade through his father's skin and muscle, piercing his heart. Instead, he'd cowered in fear, afraid even to look away. Never again, he thought now, watching his captain approach the ragtag group of soldiers keeping warm by the fire. It was bitterly cold, the air itself seeming to have teeth, biting at any scrap of exposed flesh. Then again, it was no different than any other northern winter, and it was said that northerners were born with thicker skin than those living south of the mournful mountains.
We also have thicker clothing, David mused, still watching the captain stride toward them, his head angled down and away from the icy wind, his hands stuffed in his pockets. He wore a dark greatcoat secured with bright silver buttons down the front. A greatcoat such as that was useful for blocking the wind, but too bulky to fight in. His captain's uniform would be tucked away beneath it, just in case their camp was attacked, an all-too-likely possibility south of the mountains. And under the uniform would be several other layers, the last few of which would rarely be removed, unless one wanted to lose a limb or two to frostbite. Captain Stapleton was a rough-shod man of 35, an impressive age to reach for a career soldier fighting on the front lines. His age alone ensured the respect of his men. He had a thick brown beard that crept up his cheeks and almost to his eyes, and a mop of brown hair that flopped from under his woolen cap across his forehead. Spider-webbing from his left eye was a white starburst scar.
"The mace almost took my eye,"
David had heard him say a dozen times to new recruits when asked. Then again, there were few in his troop who didn't have a scar or 10. David, even at only 16, already had more scars than most. Then again, the men, most of whom were twice his age, gathered around the fire with him, all had more scars than most. This was because they were part of an elite group of battle-hardened warriors known as the Blade, who saw more time in the fiercest battles than any other soldiers. David had volunteered for the group within a year of joining the army, when he was only 13, a decade younger than their greenest member. They'd laughed in his face. 3 years later, they didn't laugh any more. They were his brothers. He trusted them with his life, and they trusted him.
"Men, you have an assignment," Captain Stapleton said now.
At first there had been jokes about David's age, referring to him as boy or lad, but those had ended years earlier. No one doubted he was a man any more.
"Unless it involves the butcher's daughter and a skin of mead, I'm out," one man said, grinning like a banshee.
He was Torp, a smash-nosed ogre of a man who was as wide as he was tall. He always said he was out, but he always came along anyways, just for the hell of it.
"I can't promise anyone's daughter," Stapleton said, "but there will be mead for those who return." "In that case," Torp said, "push me in the right direction, and I'll bludgeon whatever happens to be in my way."
The rest of the fellows laughed. One of the others, Grigor, pulled Torp to his feet, spun him around, and shoved him hard toward the fire. Torp, more agile than he looked, managed to dance around the hot coals, getting a face full of smoke in the process. He coughed and blustered and spat out a wad of grey phlegm. The captain waited patiently, trying to hide his own amusement. He was used to their antics by now, and he wouldn't reprimand them. The risks these men took afforded them certain liberties that the other soldiers didn't enjoy, like extra rations of mead and meat. For David, it meant being sent into dangerous situations again and again and again. Each time he emerged with new scars, but the pain never managed to erase the scar he'd earned on his heart when his father had died with him looking on. "What's the mission?" he asked, suddenly feeling anxious to get on with it. Heads turned his way, but they didn't linger. The men of this company had learned long ago not to ask why David was so keen to throw himself into the fire. The captain said,
"Norris, the king wants to push our advantage."
David's teeth ground together. This was different. They'd finally won Raiders Pass, finally broken through the eastern lines and held the front. But an attack on enemy soil. It was unnecessary, a blatant attempt by the dread king to show his power. He was reaching too far for the apple. If he wasn't careful, the huntsman's axe would take his arm. Logically, David knew, Norris was the next target if they were going to continue their southward campaign. But the city was well fortified, and those who dwelt there were notoriously tough, especially when defending their domain. Hell, anyone who lived on a border these days was as tough as dried yak meat. Hence the mission, David thought. We'll be slaughtered. Something turned inside him, but it wasn't fear. It was the same strange urge he'd felt since he watched his father die. The urge to die, too. He hated feeling this way. It was why he'd had to leave his mother all alone, why he'd joined the army, why he'd volunteered for the Blade in the first place. But he wouldn't just lay down, no. If he was going to die, somebody would need to beat him. That was the only way to prove he wasn't special, that the mark on his back was nothing but a weird birthmark that happened to only appear when torchlight was shone upon it. Not a mark of power. Anything but that. David shook his head, dimly aware that a conversation had been carrying on around him while he was lost in his thoughts.
"Infiltrate the first wall. Somehow sneak across the kill zone with just the eight of us. Breach the second wall, and take out the lord of the town. Is that what you're saying?"
It was Torp again, his gruff voice accompanied by the tinkling of icicles in his thick beard.
"You understand your orders exactly," the captain said, refusing to give an inch.
Torp laughed.
"I see why you came to the Blade. We're just the men for the job."
"Yes, yes, we are," David thought.
"For the crown,"
he bellowed, raising a gloved fist in the air. His comrades echoed the cheer, though he was fairly certain none of them meant it. They didn't do this for some king halfway across the realm. They fought because it was in their blood, a need that could only be sated by battle and victory. Under a canopy of clouds in the black of night, Norris might have been naught but a hill rising up in the distance, the only evidence of its structure, the four tall watchtowers poking up from each corner. A high outer wall connected them. If the walls or towers were manned, the watchmen were well hidden. They'd begun their march several hours earlier, sticking to the shadow of the mournful mountains. This time of year the mountains were snow-covered, walls of white that extended as far as the eye could see in either direction. From the base, the carpet of white continued all the way to Norris and beyond. They wore armor, but it was painted white, from greaves to chestplates to helmets. Even their boots were painted. The lower portion of each man's face was covered by a white scarf tied tight. Only their eyes were visible. Grigor, who was the Blade's unofficial leader, dropped onto all fours as they angled away from the slopes. They would crawl the rest of the way, elbows and knees. A muffled shuffling sound rose up as the rest of the men followed suit, but the sound didn't carry. The armor had been padded around the edges. Cold snow melted and seeped through the cracks in David's armor, but it didn't bother him. Being cold was part of life as a soldier of the North. Heated by his body, the moisture felt more like sweat than anything. Thankfully, the snow wasn't as thick as it could be this deep in the season. They dug through it, plowing with their hands as they inched forward. Elbows and knees, push, push, push. Silence ruled the night. Torches flickered atop the city walls. The clouds broke for a moment, and Grigor raised a hand to pause their crawl. A swathe of green moonlight swept over the city of Norris, backlighting several shadowy forms moving across the walls.
"Flatten!"
Grigor hissed. But most of the men, David included, were already burrowed tightly against the snowy landscape, their grim stares meeting. David happened to be facing Torp, and the barrel-built man's eyes shone with mirth. If he wasn't a soldier, he'd be locked up as a madman, David thought. Still, he'd take him on his side of a skirmish any day of the year. Ice crystals sparkled like crushed emeralds as the moonlight passed overhead. The city remained silent. Their camouflage had passed the test. Thick clouds pregnant with unfallen snow blotted out the light once more. They crawled onward. "The king is no fool," David thought, his back pressed against Norris's outer wall. If they'd marched a full force on the city, the fortifications would have ensured hundreds would die before they ever got close enough to breach the first wall. A small specialized company, however, like the Blade, allowed the element of surprise. Still, they would be outnumbered 100 to 1 if they were discovered. Stealth was the key to this mission, not strength. Grigor moved from man to man, whispering his orders directly into their ears. They'd already hashed out the basics of the plan, but they all knew plans could change based on circumstances.
"East corner."
Grigor's breath was warm against David's ear. He nodded. For now, the plan was unchanged. Like a wraith, he moved noiselessly, staying close to the wall. He wasn't concerned about being seen. The watchmen would be focused outward.
Other men moved in different directions, some in front, some behind. One man for each tower, one man for each wall. Almost like the spokes inside a cartwheel. If a man was caught alone, he could pretend to be a solo operation, giving the others the opportunity to escape, or even to continue the mission. The east tower rose above him like a black cliff. David's heart beat faster, but not out of fear. It was anticipation. Of battle. Of the sword mark flaring on his back. Of the possibility of death. The only punishment left for him. He began to climb. The soles of his boots were studded with metal spikes, and each hand gripped razor-sharp knives used by woodsmen for cutting bone and tendon. He took turns with the knives, jamming them between the edges of the log wall, digging his toes in with each step upward. He was a good climber, probably the third best in the company, which was why he was scaling one of the towers. Halfway up, he paused to get his bearings, glancing left and right. Torp, one of the weaker climbers, was perhaps a quarter of the way to the top of the northeastern wall. David couldn't quite make out the progress of the form on the opposite side. Below, the land was so dark it might have been the black waters of an ancient ocean. Above, he saw the faint outline of pale fingers resting over the edge of the watchtower. At worst, the watchman would have a bow strapped to his back and a sword within arm's reach. At best, he wouldn't have a weapon close enough to grab. After all, even in times of war, 100 uneventful nights might pass without a single battle. David resumed his climb, until he began to worry the watchman would be able to hear his breathing or the sound of his knives against the wood. With the patience of a spider, he waited for the situation to change. He was so close now he could see the dirt under the man's fingernails. After what felt like an eternity, his legs began to tire, and he could feel the spikes losing their purchase on the wood, scraping downward. His arms were strong, but no one could hang forever. Soon they began to tremble. He would need to readjust his position soon. But those pale fingers remained overhead, occasionally drumming the wood. A deep yawn murmured through the night. One of the hands lifted into the air, presumably to cover the offending mouth. The other hand rose as well, stretching to the sky. David Dietrich made his move. If he'd been asked to explain how his sword mark worked, David wouldn't have been able to. It was like he'd stolen someone else's body the moment he drew his sword. Someone stronger, faster, more expert, and this time was no different. The sword slid smoothly from his scabbard as he abandoned one of the climbing knives, which continued to protrude from the wall. He dug his spiked boots into the wood and leapt, swinging his non-sword hand overhead, stabbing the other climbing knife into the highest slot he could reach, pulling upward with all his might, the knife bending under his weight. The metal might have broken if he'd continued dangling from it, but he was already gone, springing upward where the watchman had heard the commotion. The man leaned over, his eyes widening, displaying broad black pupils used to long hours staring into abject darkness. David hated how easy it was for him to separate the man's throat. Choking on his own blood, the man barely made a sound as David caught him with his offhand and gently laid him onto the top of the tower, which was surrounded by wooden ramparts. Glancing around the small square space, David felt sick. There were no weapons save for a rack containing several bows and a barrel full of fletched arrows. The man never had a chance. David wondered whether he had a family. He wondered whether he was a good man. Both questions he would never get to ask him. Why did I kill him? Because the king ordered me to. No, he couldn't even use that excuse. The king had only ordered the blade to kill the lord of the city, not to kill any of the soldiers. Though it was probably implied. He would have killed me if I didn't kill him. That excuse was just as flimsy. With his sword mark, he could best any man one-on-one 100 times out of 100. 1,000 out of 1,000. I should have knocked him out. But then he might have awoken before we completed the mission. I would have been risking the lives of my friends, my brothers. David hated this. This doubt. This kind of killing. It was different when your lands were being attacked. Killing was survival. Killing was the only choice. But now they were the ones attacking, threatening. They were the invaders. He took a deep breath. Now wasn't the time, not when the rest of his company had presumably secured their own positions. If not, the city's warning bells would have already been sounded. Which likely meant that 8 Easterners, including the man sprawled before him in a pool of his own blood, were dead. He released his breath, watching the hot air mist outward, form ghost-like fingers, and then disappear. He slid his thumb along the hilt of his sword, which felt more like a natural extension of his hand than a weapon. He bent down and opened the hatch to the tower's ladder, trying not to notice the way the blood dripped from cracks and crevices in the wood. The space between the inner and outer wall was known as the Kill Zone, and David had heard countless stories of battles lost in the very space he was now sprinting across, as easily as an antelope bounding through a spring meadow. Had they breached the outer wall with an army, arrows would now be falling like rain, waterfalls of boiling water and tar tumbling over the ramparts, and legions of defenders charging through the secondary gates. Instead, his approach was unfettered, unnoticed, the second wall looming ahead, not as tall as the first, its surface pocked with scars, telling the story of countless battles. Battles which the wall had won, its foes laid low in the mud and snow. Not tonight. Tonight, the blade would cut deep into the heart of its city, a swift, unassailable blow. Reaching the second wall, David drew another climbing knife, but didn't sheathe his sword. Instead, he climbed with one arm and both legs, while continuing to grip his blade. He made short work of the wall, peering over the edge. No movement. Wait. There. A dark form breached the wall. Then another, and another, and another still. All around the wall, the members of the blade slipped over, unmolested. Unseen. Wraiths, all of us, David thought. The undead. He hauled himself over the edge, crouch-walked across the wall, and slung his legs over the opposite side. Finding a ladder would take too long. Now that they had breached the city's 2 main defenses, time was of the essence. The sooner they got in and out, the better. He half-slid, half-climbed down the wall, landing softly in a snowdrift. The snow inside the city had been shoveled, pushed against the sides of the wall in large, sloped hills, leaving the inner village with only a dusting of white, like powdered sugar on a cake. Something struck David as strange. Why were there no guards atop the second wall? As he stared at the rows of structures laid out neat and orderly beyond the main courtyard, he puzzled over this question. Obviously, if an enemy army was attacking, both walls would be full of archers. But he supposed it made sense that at night the focus would be on detecting their foes. If the enemy was spotted, the alarm would sound, and hundreds of men would climb onto the walls in a matter of seconds. Too easy, David thought, the words bothering him. Nothing in his life had been easy so far. Why should anything be different tonight? Further along the wall, Gregor raised a hand. Each member mirrored the signal. As one, they crept forward, weapons at the ready. The structures were small but sturdy, their walls constructed of thick timber, the cracks filled with mortar. Solid oak doors barred each from entry. Wisps of smoke arose from dozens of chimneys, the promise of warmth in a land where winter days were cold and nights frigid. Given the cloudy night and numerous structures, shadows were plentiful, which allowed the blade to dart from dark space to dark space unseen. Twice Torp stubbed his toe on the edge of a building or a rock and cursed, but the wind carried his voice away before it could reach any slumbering ear. The only problem? All of the buildings looked the same. Finding Lord Norris wouldn't be easy in a city like this. Gregor stopped.
"Any ideas?" he asked in a hushed tone. "Knock on the door and ask for directions," Torp suggested. "Any ideas from someone other than Torp?"
Gregor asked.
"Bastard. Can I help that my father kept a mistress?"
That shut Torp up. A clever quip usually did. David said,
"Even on a quiet night like this, he will have guards. The lord of a castle is always at risk of mutiny, especially in winter."
Torp said,
"This is no castle."
But Gregor was already nodding.
"We'll split into 2 parties of 4, search block by block. Whoever finds the lord is the winner.
Meet back here before the green moon reaches its peak.
David thanked the frozen gods of the north when he wasn't matched with Torp. The man was worse than an ice bear blundering through a snowstorm. His foursome was comprised of Chaunt, a mischievous man who liked to keep track of the various ways he'd killed a man, Boar, a quiet type who did as he was told, and Mick, whose lips were nearly always pulled back into a jackal's smile, especially in the midst of a battle. The first block was uneventful and thick with shadows. No one spoke as they filed in a single line, David at their head. Though he was the youngest, they'd seen what he could do in battle. The second block was much the same, and the third. David began to doubt himself. Perhaps he was wrong. Maybe the lords of the East were so unpretentious that they lived amongst their people, unprotected, without fear of mutiny or uprising. Perhaps the lords of the East were loved. He peered around the corner to the fourth block, and his breath caught in his chest, a cold, icy stab. Three guards stood outside one of the structures, breathing into their gloved hands and stamping their feet to keep warm.
"They each have a sword," Chaunt said, and then, "I've never killed a man with his own sword before."
"And you're not going to now," David said. Chaunt grinned like he'd been joking, though it was clear he was not. The guards were four houses down. One was smoking. One was talking non-stop. The third kept laughing and slapping his knees. Smiling from ear to ear, Mick said,
"I see blades strapped to their boots, too. Watch out for those."
"We're not taking them out," Boar said.
David liked the man because he knew how to listen, which meant he understood most things before they were said aloud.
"What do you mean?"
Chaunt said.
"We're the winners. To the victors, the spoils."
"Lord Norris is the spoils," David said. "Not his guards. We kill him and leave the rest unless absolutely necessary." The thought of the eight men they'd already killed spread like a pool of blood in his mind.
"No one will even know we—"
"Lord Norris," David said again. Chaunt chewed his lip. Mick smiled. Boar nodded. "Let's go," David pointed up. No one grumbled, each man beginning to climb once more. Just another reason David was glad to be rid of Torp, who believed complaining was a lost art form. The roofs were gabled, allowing the heavy snow to be pushed off before it could crush the structures below. Beneath the snow was a thin layer of ice. David scrabbled for purchase, eventually pressing his knife through the ice and into the wood.
"Killing the guards would be easier,"
Chaunt pointed out, breathing heavily. Hanging with one arm, he fingered a half-dozen small knives strapped to his belt. They were meant for throwing, and David had seen the man hit enemies with pinpoint accuracy many times. Even from this strange angle, he was certain Chaunt could kill at least two of the three guards. The third, however, would raise the alarm. "We climb." So they did, cautiously making their way over the apex of the structure, and then sliding slowly down the other side. Each house shared a wall, so it was as easy as climbing again. Climb, slide, climb, slide. When they reached the target structure, they stopped. David pointed to his ear before any of them could say anything. Wind whistled between the buildings. Somewhere a dog barked. There were no other sounds, no voices. David crept forward until he could peek one eye over the edge of the roof.
"Shite,"
he thought. The guards were gone.
"Maybe they got cold,"
Chaunt said.
"My man parts are frozen solid."
David considered the possibility the guards had simply gone inside to warm up. Something about it didn't feel right. Maybe they didn't do things the same in the east as they did in the north, but he didn't believe men would up and abandon their posts. "They haven't raised the alarm," David said. Mick nodded, his grin more of a sneer now.
"We go in quick and professional. No one will be the wiser until morning light."
David couldn't argue with that. Boar remained silent, waiting for someone else to decide. Something didn't feel right, but David couldn't pinpoint what. "We'll go through the back window," he said. Climbing down to the window was more difficult than climbing up, but eventually they managed to lower themselves far enough to look through the frosted window pane. Dark curtains blocked further sight. Chaunt made a motion like he would smash through the glass, but David shook his head. He reached over and dug his fingernails beneath the window frame. Slowly, he pried it open. It was unlatched. Wind bullied its way through the opening, the curtains fluttering. In a single motion, David swung through the window, less concerned about making a little noise now, more concerned with speed. The room was dark, but enough light spilled through the window that he could see the bed, chair, and table. No one sprang from the bed, a scream on their lips. No guards burst through the door, weapons flashing. No one moved, except for David's comrades, who pushed in behind him. David pressed a finger to his lips and pointed at the bed, where a long lump bulged beneath the bedcovers. Too easy, David thought again, his heart fluttering wildly in his chest. He approached silently, dimly aware of the snow tumbling from his boots, leaving a wet trail behind him. He raised his sword, wondering whether Lord Norris was a good or bad man. In this moment he wondered if it even mattered any more. Was there such a thing as good and bad in war? He brought the sword down with the muffled whump, stabbing right through the covers, judging where the man's chest would be. David had killed many men in his short 16 years of life, and he knew when he'd been duped. He threw back the covers to find 3 pillows laid in a row, the one in the middle a mess of feathers and slashed fabric. That's when the bells began to peal. Footsteps thundered down below. Cries joined the howling wind. The sharp exclamation points of metal meeting metal clangored from the streets. "We've got to move," Chaunt said. Though there was fear in his voice, there was excitement too. He was a man who loved battle more than anything. The footsteps drew nearer, pounding up the steps, which presumably led to a hall which led to the closed doorway to the very room they were in. David's mind ticked over the situation. Chaunce was already at the open window, the curtains swirling around him. He looked back expectantly. Mick was close at his heels. Boar was staring at David. David said, "Our cover is blown. We are outnumbered. The hallway and staircase will even the odds." Boar nodded, drawing his sword, a gesture that said what his lips did not. "I'm with you." Footsteps, louder, harder, more frantic. Chaunce narrowed his eyes, a gleam filling them. David could almost see the man, picturing all the different ways he'd get to kill on this night. Mick's grin was broad and toothy. The enemy was so close now, David could feel the floorboards vibrating beneath his feet. He turned and opened the door, his sword mark burning in the center of his back. The man hadn't expected the door to open, his face awash with surprise as he tried to stop his weapon, a large hammer, still swinging at his side. David used his momentum against him, stabbing his sword out like a spear. The man ran into the tip, his breath rushing out as the blade entered his gut. David wrenched the sword back, simultaneously kicking his foe back, where he crashed into the next man. They sprawled to the floor, their arms and legs akimbo. The third man was just behind them, as was the fourth, leaping over their fallen comrades, unleashing a pair of war cries so loud in the small space they were almost like weapons. David had heard a lot of war cries over the last 3 years. None had changed the result. He blocked the first slash on the broad side of his sword, pirouetting around him to meet the next foe with a kick to the groin. The man bent over in pain, and David found a weak spot in his armor and ended him. Behind him he heard the sounds of a struggle, but he didn't turn. He trusted the other three to handle one man with ease. Instead, he focused on the next two enemies, galloping from the staircase and onto the landing. They stopped, taking in their fallen allies with narrowed eyes. "You're trapped," one of them said. "So are you," David said, and then he attacked. He feinted left, launching a kick that crunched against the man's knee, his leg buckling from the impact. His sword was moving the entire time, faster than should be possible for even the most expert of swordsmen. His sword mark was fire, the tempest raging through his blood, his bones, his muscles. The second enemy's head bounced down the steps, glancing off the legs of other foes. This was survival. "Best me, and I will die gladly," David thought, grabbing the man whose knee he'd shattered, hauling him to his feet. "I will go to meet my father. I will go to face him, an apology on my lips." The man screamed in pain. David launched him down the staircase, his armor clattering against the other men, knocking them back. Perhaps half a dozen landed in a heap, while dozens more pushed in around them. The tight space truly was evening the odds.
"Save some for me, will you?"
Chaunt said, sidling up beside him. Just as two of the men were trying to regain their feet, Chaunt flicked each of his wrists in short succession. The men fell back, a knife in their foreheads.
"Never done two at once like that," Chaunt said. "Next I'll have to try three."
"You can have 300 if it gets us out of here," David said, starting down the steps. They moved slowly, one step at a time, killing as they went. They took turns at the front, so the others could catch their breaths. In the throes of his swordmark's power, David didn't really need to rest, but the other members of the Blade insisted. Eventually they won the staircase and moved into a larger room, full of enemies standing their ground, waiting patiently. A door stood open behind them. "They are getting smarter," David thought. "Everyone okay?" David asked the others. Blood sheeted down Chaunce's face. Boar was favouring his left arm. Mick's smile had faded slightly, and he seemed to be clutching his side. David, as usual, was unscathed. Chaunce said,
"Flesh wounds, all of them. Am I right?"
The others nodded, though it didn't mean much. The saying was one coined by the Blade long before David's time. It meant they would fight to the last breath, even if they were dying. The dozen or so men standing before them advanced, spreading out. Smarter, David thought again. Do what they least expect. He moved like crashing lightning, leaping into their midst, so he was fully surrounded. His sword was a refracted blade of light, whistling in an arc as he spun. Everyone froze. Crimson smiles appeared on pale throats. Men fell, one by one, like dominoes. "I am death incarnate. I have killed many. I have saved many. But I could not save my father." David shook his head. No, that wasn't right. "I would not save him."
"If you didn't scare me so much," John said, "I'd reprimand you for stealing all my kills again."
The streets were chaos. Men charged from every direction, most toward them, but some in another direction. Presumably toward where the other four members of the Blade were, fighting for their lives.
"Follow them!"
David cried, suddenly anxious to be reunited with the rest of his company. Maybe the eight of them together could cut a path through the throng and escape. It was a long shot, but it was all they had. Following them was more difficult than wading through quicksand. Enemies barred every passage. Hundreds stacked to the side and behind, and in front, and around. Blood dripped from David's chin, elbows, and sword, none of it his. His blade never stopped moving, slashing, hacking, cutting, stabbing, ending. Always ending. Mick went down first, still smiling even as the final blade entered his heart, his expression frozen forevermore in that final look of glee. Chaunce, who had long ago run out of knives, was next. He shouted something as he died, but whatever he said was lost in a gurgle. Boar hung on for a long time, the quiet man a force to be reckoned with, his blows swift and decisive. But even he could not survive this disastrous night. David was alone, surrounded by enemies. His entire body shook with sadness at those he'd lost, with anger at the dread king for sending them to this hell-frozen place, for killing his father. The anger fueled him, becoming a mark of power of its own, until he was nothing but white-hot rage, a force of nature. He didn't know how many he'd killed, their cries of death melting together into a single stream of anguish. A light in the dark.
"Gregor!"
David cried.
"Gregor!"
Seeing the man alone, pushed back against the wall as he tried to fight for enough space to begin his climb, gave David a new sense of purpose. Gregor's head darted to meet his eyes.
"Oh, no,"
David thought, realizing his error too late. The distraction, though brief, was enough to seal the man's fate. A blade snuck between his defenses. As he stared at David, his eyes widened. A sad smile creased his lips. He fell. David closed his eyes, dropped to his knees, his sword tumbling from his fingertips.
"I surrender," he said. "Kill me."
He was chained to a metal horse in the center of the town's yard.
His eyes were closed. His ears barely heard the murmurings around him. Kill the bastard. Execute him. Death! 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 He'd failed his brothers, just like he'd failed his father. This time at least he had tried, but it wasn't enough. Was never enough. More than ever before, David Dietrich truly wanted to die. "Look at me,"